The speakers tonight will be following a little bit of what they tell us in that fifth chapter. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The chairman is supposed to qualify himself at the beginning of a meeting by custom. Today, we're going to abandon that custom because really there's nothing in my drinking story that's particularly interesting. There are many things in my recovery story that are quite interesting. I don't know how many of them I want to tell about. One thing that does seem to get quite a bit of interest is a little story about how I handle certain responsibilities. And one of these is my financial abilities. I am totally and completely irresponsible from a financial standpoint. And this was brought home to me very starkly after I had been sober for approximately 3 years. My wife, my accountant, the president of the bank got me to sit down and discuss my financial situation. This was after 3 years of sobriety. Because I felt when I came into the program that at least one thing I had done was to leave my family in pretty good financial shape. Now, I happen to sit on the board of directors of two different banks. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with banking procedures, but being on the board of directors of the bank is almost better than having a license to steal. And every month for about 10 years, once each month I sat on each board and I listened to the banks, listened to all the problems that people get into, the tales of woe, and how people get into financial difficulty. And this was fine, except that it didn't have any effect on me. I was different. I always was different. And I always used to say, you know, that I didn't want to be on a discount committee, I just wanted to have friends on it. Well, I had friends on it. And when I wanted money, all I'd do would be sign my name to a piece of paper. And occasionally, they would tell me that this was due, that I had to do something about it. And so I'd sign my name to another piece of paper. And sometimes, because I was a specially nice guy, they'd give me a couple of extra $1,000. And I thought that was a pretty neat thing. But all of a sudden, after some 3 years of sobriety, they decided that they wanted my money because they had my name on their stinking little pieces of paper. And that didn't make much sense to me. See, my thinking was pretty sick. I was insane. But eventually, I came to realize that they really had to do this. And that part that Dr. Ed read, that great decision we make, if you've decided you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length, part of the any length I had to go to making restitution was to turn my financial affairs completely over to other people. Part of this entailed me not being permitted to carry a checkbook. My wife carries a checkbook. My kids all have checking accounts. The girls in the office can write checks. I am the only director of a national bank in the United States of America who's not permitted to carry a checkbook in his own bank. It's part of my disease. I accept that just as I do everything else. One day at a time, it's kind of nice. You know, we do learn to live a little, we learn to laugh a little, and eventually things do come around. Tonight, we're going to have some very serious things to say, because the people who are going to talk to you have some very serious stories to tell. These are stories of degradation. They're stories of loss. They're stories of calamity. They're stories of sadness. As Bill Wilson said, this is a program, you know, of spiritual growth. This is what we read about in the fifth chapter. It is a spiritual program. And spiritual growth always comes with pain, with suffering, with calamity. When we meet these things with God's help, they do come. The program is supposed to last for 2 hours. If our speakers run over 2 hours, I'm not going to stop them. If anybody feels they have to leave, this is fine. We don't have any red lights, any light system of any sort up here, so we're just going to have an AA meeting until we get tired of talking. The first man that I want to introduce has been a friend of mine for a long time. His identical twin brother was my partner in medical school. And he has had a problem also, and I like to tell this story because, you know, miracles happen. Since Joe and I have been together the last few days, we've talked quite a bit about Jim. And today we met a man from Jim's hometown. He told Joe, Jim is now in the program, he's working the program, and when we get home tonight, we're going to call up Jim, see if we can have any more luck in getting through a telephone secretary than any of you do when you try to call a physician at night. And if we do, we're going to congratulate on him. But I would like to introduce Joe.
Thank you, Larry. My name is Joe, and I'm an ordinary garden variety pill-popping drunk. And I better not forget that again, because I learned that once and I forgot it. I was talking briefly with Paul before the meeting started, and I suggested that I would be able to impart to my family here some ways that one doesn't do things. Particularly, I'm going to be talking about alcohol equivalent drugs. But let me go back to talk with you about how I got here. I guess we're in the new section of the Brown Palace Hotel. Some 30 years ago and a few months ago, I was in the old section of the Brown Palace Hotel, being stationed at Lowry Field. I was in it once, and I was drunk. And I haven't been back since. And so it's nice to come back this way. I'm an addict. I'm a chemical freak. I'm a kind of person who early in life got hooked on the idea of getting high. And I'll tell you how it started. At the age of 16, I was in a high school play. I had a secondary role. I was, like most 16-year-olds, tongue-tied, ill at ease, uncomfortable. And after the play was over, a fellow by the name of George brought in some Italian red wine, and I had two or three glugs of that Italian red wine. And from a clumsy, awkward, you know, very, very preoccupied, frightened teenager, I found myself doing cartwheels on the back of the stage. I became the party after the play. Something extraordinary happened to me. The phenomenon of getting high. The DuPont Corporation, about this time in the early 40s, developed the slogan, "Better living through chemistry." And I chased that slogan for some 20 or 25 years. So I can safely say that most everything out there that you can take to move you one way or another has gone down my gullet, in my lungs, or through my veins. I didn't instantly get in trouble with drinking. I went through military service. I was an alcoholic then. I escaped a reduction in grade, a minor kind of court-martial, because the executive officer's mother died. But I came out with an unblemished war record only because of a natural phenomenon over which I had no control. I went on and went through college, and after the war, and I guess the reason I did fairly well in college was I just wasn't drinking that much yet. I had been in trouble with my drinking from the very beginning, from the time I was 16. I assumed that by the time I was 26, I was actively, clearly an alcoholic. You know, medical school is hard work. Going through medical school as an active alcoholic is tough. Those other fellows had 6-7 nights a week to study, and I had 4 or 5 because I spent 2, 3, or 4 drinking. But I got through medical school. And I got through an internship. And I had begun then. I had a preceptor. That's somebody who teaches you. Another classmate of mine, a fellow by the name of Ray, who introduced me to all of the drugs while I was in medical school. Ray is dead some 10 or 12 years now from an overdose of drugs. But I had plenty of experience. My wife vacillated back and forth as to whether she would marry me or not. But I mailed all the invitations. So she married me. Twice. But we'll get to that later. The first marriage was kind of rocky. I went up to the coal fields of West Virginia to make a lot of money. And because that wasn't solidly in the middle of the Bible Belt, I found I could no longer drink hard whiskey, so I did what only, you know, any sensible addict would do. I started on morphine. And I was able, and here's the catch, and I think it's so important to we, those of us who are addicts, those of us who are kind of masters in deceit of ourselves, and secondarily of other people. I could fake it on drugs. I could get by, and people would think I was all right. And so I did. But I got hooked on drugs, and I had to get off of drugs. And once I got off of drugs, I went back to drinking, and when I went to drinking, my drinking had already become a very bad scene. I rapidly blacked out, and I became very obscene, antisocial, fighting, terrible when I drank. And so once I started drinking, I only lasted a couple of weeks in this job in West Virginia, in the coal fields, and I came back. This was followed by a series of hospitalizations during which my wife left and was not to return for a number of years. And things went steadily downhill between 1955 and 1960. And there came a point in time in 1960 where I found myself a committed patient on the back ward of a mental hospital, sleeping on a straw mattress, shaking the cockroaches out of my shoes and rolling my own cigarettes. And a wonderful idea came through my head one morning. I said to myself, Joe, maybe there's something wrong with you. And that was wisdom. And I got a hold of AA. And two very important people In our lives, many of the important AA people in our lives are here tonight. But Tom and Peg, who are AA friends of ours, Tom's a minister in the program. And Peg and Hazel had gone to nursing school together, and she'd been gone 5 years, and, you know, I had sent her some checks for some money I'd owed her, and they hadn't bounced. And I'd gotten out to a medical convention or two and gotten involved in the business of taking care of alcoholics once I got into AA, and I got into AA, as I say, in the spring of 1960, and my sobriety date then was June the 7th of 1960. And it was to stay my sobriety date for a few years. But Peg and Tom knew that I was in this thing, and when Hazel came back and couldn't understand what was happening, checks weren't bouncing, I wasn't blaming her for all my misfortunes, and I was writing, you know, grateful things like, I'm a lucky guy. And so she came back to find out whether it was for real or not, and Peg told her it was, and we got together. And that summer I went to Yale. And that fall we got married. We started off on a great and wonderful AA life. And that's where the story should have ended. But it didn't. In those first few years in AA, I had become very involved in the externals of the program. In terms of an internal spiritual awakening, this hadn't happened with me. But I was involved in AA. I was working with alcoholics. I got involved in the business of treating alcoholics and working at the city hospital and writing papers about taking care of sick alcoholics and checking out drugs to see if they were worthwhile in the treatment of alcoholic withdrawal syndromes. I'm becoming something of an authority on drugs. And a lot of things were going on. But in 1964, I gave up my active affiliation with Alcoholics Anonymous and my active involvement in AA and in the field of alcoholism to take up training in psychiatry. Now, there's nothing wrong with training in psychiatry by itself. However, the way I went about it turned out to be wrong for me. For as Paul said this evening, psychologists and psychiatrists, if they have an alcohol or drug problem, they get well in places like this. And this is where recovery has occurred for me, is in rooms like this. I went into training in psychiatry. I stopped not entirely going to meetings, but I stopped going to closed meetings. I stopped going to the step meetings. I stopped going to, you know, I stopped really talking with a sponsor. I'm a hard-nosed, tough guy for a sponsor. His name was Bob. He's sober in this program now, I guess, 25, 26 years. And Bob wouldn't let me get away with anything, but I got away from Bob. I grew up in a way, and, you know, I felt very good about you, but somehow or another, I felt I didn't really need you anymore. There came a time about a year later. There came a time about a year later when I was very anxious. My wife and newborn son were in the hospital, and he was critically ill and premature, and I had a daughter in the hospital with a urinary thing, and I was working very hard in my residency in psychiatry, and I had become an authority on drugs. I knew a great deal about drugs. But knowledge is not virtue. And there came a time when I suddenly remembered that a medical director from one of the pharmaceutical corporations, had mentioned that when he got very uptight and very, very restless and had a headache and couldn't rest, that he would take 2 green and black Libriums. The first night I took 3. I always took more. That was began not a sudden cataclysmic, you know, drunk or binge or starting on drugs. No, it wasn't as simple as that. It was to come about in a very much more subtle, slow, destructive way. All of the good, wonderful, warm, healthy personality developing kind of early spiritual things that perhaps had begun to happen to me were to slowly disintegrate and be eaten away. And so it happened. And it happened over a very long period of time. It happened over 7 years. So I began drugs in 65, and I wasn't really taking all of them that many in 65 or 66 or 67, really. It was about 68 or 69 before I got into taking them. By 1970, I was taking them all day, every day. At the same time, I would still go to your meeting, and I would talk about my 10 years of sobriety. And in terms of booze, that was true. I wasn't talking to anyone. I didn't have any program. All I had was that terrible, incomplete thing. Me. I didn't talk with my wife. I didn't talk with my children. I'd become, by this point in time, addicted to many drugs. I was taking 4 or 5 different drugs pretty much all of the time. My life had become a disaster. In 71, I went away for treatment for 3 months in the summer of 71. I went out to a alcoholism rehabilitation center in Minnesota, Hazelden. And some of my Hazelden friends are here this evening. And I stayed 5 weeks. And I was already the medical director of a treatment center. I knew what to say. So I said the right things. And after 5 weeks, they told me they thought I had a choice. They were wrong. I didn't have a choice. Nothing really had changed. And I came back, and after 5 or 6 weeks, I did the most natural thing in the world. I went back to taking drugs because nothing really had changed. And so for 6 or 7 more months, I took drugs again. And so back in June 19th of 1972, I went into Hazelden to be their first Quaalude withdrawal. This is the kind of insanity my life was marked by. I had become a guinea pig. All reason had left me. That time, when I went to the treatment center, some important things had been happening in the meantime. Back on the home front, my wife had gotten involved in Al-Anon. Now that can be tough on a guy like me, or any of us. I'd been there in this Hazelden about 4 weeks, and they were talking some dreadful things to me about my being sicker than most people, and that I better plan to stick around and help trim the Christmas tree, and this was July. I developed all sorts of crushing chest pains, which they obligingly worked out. They had me see some very fine people in Minneapolis and St. Paul to be sure there was nothing wrong with my crushing chest pains. But in the meantime, I was ready to split out of there anyhow. And I called up. And I was just informing my good wife that I'd probably be home on, you know, United's flight 521 the following day. And she said, well, we won't be here. I had some, you know, expletives about Al-Anon. But thank God I did stay. And kind of after I kind of gave up and decided I'd really start, and Paul said this again tonight, if I just start to follow the directions, do what I was told. And you know, in August of 1972, I stopped having chest pain. And I haven't had any chest pain since. And I always had chest pain. I was always ready to die from an imminent myocardial infarction. You know, ready to go. But I haven't had any pain. They told me it was important for someone like me to learn a little bit about humility. So they suggested that I resign, like, from everything. Because I've gotten, you know, an extraordinarily inappropriate idea as to how important I was. And I've been on this or that committee and consultant here, there, and elsewhere, and so on. And so it was important for me to not be those things anymore. So I went through a few weeks out there resigning from things. I had a lot of other kind of good things start to happen, though. When I was leaving there, they suggested that, you know, that I go to a halfway house. And I said, no, wait a minute, I'm the medical director of one and chairman of the board of a couple others. And they said, no, we didn't ask you to put one together. We want you to go to one. And they gave me a choice between St. Paul and Baltimore. Baltimore was 65 miles from where I lived, and St. Paul was 1,200. So I went to a halfway house. And at that point in time, I was about as heavy then as I am now, but I had a great big, full, white beard. I dye my hair. But I had a big, full, white beard. And I was looking for Santa Claus jobs, but they were all gone. And they found a job for me from 6 to 10 in the morning on the cleanup crew from Montgomery Ward's, which was about a mile and a half from the halfway house, and I didn't have a car, and I found myself walking down Route 1 in the cold December rain mornings to go to this job to clean up the floors in Montgomery Ward. And one morning, about the second or third morning I was there, I was walking down. I said, Joe, what are you doing here? And a little voice came through the back of my head like it had when I'd been in the mental hospital. And the little voice said, dummy, you belong here. But you know how we are. We get a hold of things and we're kind of like terriers. We shake them and we won't let them go. And so I decided if I was going to work for Ward's, they were going to have good, clean floors. So this other fellow and I went to work on them. I don't know what shape those floors are in now, but I do know what shape they were in come about January of 1973. And I got promoted from $1.60 an hour to $2 an hour. And I was getting ready to leave there to look for work in the field of alcoholism or psychiatry. I was getting around looking for a job. And when they found out I was going to leave, they offered me $2.50 an hour second in command, a permanent job. So I know that if I don't make it out here, I can come back to Ward's. They told me that. I think the miracle for some of us in AA happens more than once. I think it happens often, perhaps a couple of times. I think the miracle is starting to happen for me now, just a little over 3 years. My sobriety date is June the 28th of 1972, when I had my last 150 milligrams of Quaalude given to me by D. Smith, the RN, at Hazelden. But I think the miracle can happen again, and it's starting to happen for me. It's starting to happen for Hazel and I, for our kids, for our life. You know, I worried about all these titles and laurels and things and money. I never had any trouble making money. My problem was pills. You know, I kept forgetting that. My problem is staying clean and dry. I'd kind of like to interrupt and preach at you a second. And I want to preach at the people here this past Tuesday, prior to coming here. I saw two men in my office, both of whom are from the East Coast, both of whom have 30 years of being dry in this program or more, and both of whom are badly hooked on pills. And what kind of pills are they? There's things like Librium, or Valium, or Daridin, or Miltown, or Cerax, or the barbiturates. Addicts are addicts. The folks at Hazelden use the idea of chemical dependency. And I think going back to what Dr. Bradley talked about earlier, and which was such a splendid lecture, the very idea that you just cannot take alcohol equivalent drugs and be sober. You know, there's no difference between a green and black Librium, 2 milligrams of Valium, a quarter grain of phenobarbital, and 1 ounce of ethyl alcohol. They are the same drugs. We've got a gynecologist from Georgia in the International Doctors in AA, and he's a fabulous guy, and he's taken those pills for a long time. And he gets up at the meetings, and he says, keep it simple. Drink. And it would have been much more simple for me had I drank, because my drinking was cataclysmic and destructive. But I don't have to concentrate on that anymore. I have to concentrate now on the fact that life is becoming very meaningful to me. I'm very active in AA. I get to 2 or 3 step meetings a week. I get to an average of perhaps 5 meetings a week. And I have all those titles and laurels and responsibilities back. And I'm consulting here, there, and everywhere again, you know. It's not a big deal. If you're a sober doc and you know something about sick drunks, you're going to go to work. There's more. I have job security. I don't have to worry about those things. I have to worry about me. And I know that good things will happen to me, and many of the promises of this program have already been realized in my life. I've come to establish a relationship with God as I understand him at a far more intimate, productive level. I forget to keep asking him for help. And I tend to, you know, get myself all in a squirrel cage and all mixed up and turned around simply because I won't shut up and sit down and listen or take the third step. But it's not as bad this year as it was last year. And things get gradually, slowly, progressively better. There are lots of questions about pills and booze. And when I say drugs, I'm including such things as acid, marijuana, grass. I'm including anything that's going to bend your head one way or the other. And we have to include these things. My experience with, and I hate like the Dickens to say this to the younger people, particularly in terms of grass, because it's so popular. But I have to say, what is the recorded experience of the people in this business? And if you're going to smoke marijuana and you've had a drinking problem, the chances are you're going to drink. And the interesting thing I want to tell you about Librium and Valium and drugs like that is, are you going to get hooked on those? Well, you can. Valium addiction is the second most common diagnosis I write after alcohol addiction. But that isn't the big danger. My friends from New York tell me that if you are on Librium and Valium and you are a recovering alcoholic, sure, you might get hooked on Librium or Valium, but you are five times more likely to drink. And let's not forget that. There are some alcoholics who need various medications, but they are the exception. And maybe you ought to have a doc around or somebody around that knows something about this sort of thing that you can ask questions from. You know, when Larry called me one Tuesday afternoon here in April and asked me to come out here, my first response was to say, no. But then some wisdom in me said, yes. Yes, I have to do what I'm asked to do. And my being here on this panel tonight is clearly the finest honor of my adult life. And I'd like to thank you people and the God of my understanding for making that possible. Thank you.
Joe speaks about job security. We know what he's talking about. We have another form of job security, too. A number of my patients are in the audience tonight, and they'll tell you something that I always tell all of my patients, and that is that the only thing that we can do for anybody from a medical standpoint is the key for, speaking of alcoholism or drug withdrawal, is that we can keep them alive long enough so they can make up their own mind if they want to live or die. And this is really all we can do for them. And anything we do, unless it serves as a bridge to AA, is not likely to be successful over any long period of time. All we can do medically is detoxify somebody, take care of the complications, spend the rest of the time in trying to break down a denial mechanism that's such a fantastic part of the alcoholic personality. I think one piece of literature that everybody in AA should read is an Al-Anon literature, the merry-go-round named Denial. It's one of the most meaningful pieces of literature on alcoholism, on the disease of alcoholism that's ever been written. And if you think the story that Joe told about the long-termers is something that's unique, 2 years ago I had the opportunity to hospitalize a man who had been sober at that time for 29 years, now for 31 years. He developed sciatica, and there was quite a bit of pain connected with it. And he went and saw a doctor. The doctor belonged to a group where there were about four doctors in the group. His wife called me to go out and see him. I went out and see him. I had to help him to urinate. He couldn't even hold his pecker in his hand and hit the bowl. I took 27 bottles of pills away from him, and he'd been under treatment for less than 2 weeks. And he had 29 years of sobriety when this thing started. I went to my home meeting, the Del Mar Group in Aurora, right here in Colorado. And I cried. I was so mad that I cried because the doctors who were treating him are good doctors. They really are good doctors. They're intelligent. They know what they're doing. But they don't understand one damn thing about alcoholism. Part of my geographic cure was joining organizations. And one organization I belonged to was the Knights of Columbus. I became a Grand Knight. And we used to have a real neat technique in the Knights of Columbus. We used to have long meetings, just like you've had, and many of you have been sitting for hours and hours and hours. And we had people that we called bishops. And we always used to keep a bishop around every once in a while. And when we'd introduce a bishop, everybody would get to stand up and applaud. We used to call these things short shakers. So if anybody wants to stand up, shake out their shorts, move around a little bit, sit down, we'll have our next speaker. Maybe doctors. There is a group that's known as the International Doctors in AA. This is a group that was founded in 1949, and they meet once a year in various places around the country. They're going to meet this year at the Breakers in Palm Beach, Florida, July 30th and August 1st, 1975. Correction, this is July 30th to August the 3rd of 1975. So any of you who are interested, if you'll see any of the members of the panel, Dr. Ed is a founding member of the group. We can give you the information on it. The next speaker is a man that I knew first as a medical student. And I've gotten to like this guy. He has one interesting thing. Oftentimes, and usually at our meetings, we'll ask people, you know, how long has it been since you had a drink, or who is the newest person, or any new people here at the meeting, attending for their first, second, or third meeting, and if so, how long has it been since you've been sober? And this fellow, when I first met him at a meeting, after some long number of years after he graduated from medical school, he got up at an AA meeting, and believe it or not, he said, well, I had a drink at the bar on the way into the meeting. So that was the shortest time I think I've ever seen. Joe?
It wasn't the bar, it was the airplane flying to the meeting. My name is Joe Cruz, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I was at Hazelden also in August of 71. That's exactly the same time that Joe was. I first went to AA in April of 70. My sobriety date for the Texans is the 3rd of August, 73, so you know that my tenure in August of 71 was not totally successful. I sat three times a day in a meeting next to that. No, Joe was really sort of a godsend at Hazelden for me, because I had the doctor hang-up so badly, and I think most of my story revolves around that hang-up. My daughter just graduated from nurse's training 3 weeks ago. She said since she's been working in the hospital, she realizes the doctors go to medical school for one thing, and that's to learn that their birthday is on December 25th. And he and I both have initials JC, so it makes it double tough. This is sort of I'm sort of a last-minute substitute. If you look at your program, you don't see two Joseph C's listed. I'm from Palm Springs, California, and one of the panel members was unable to make it, so Larry cornered me, tied me, and startled me yesterday and asked me to speak here. And it's a closing of a circle for me because this is my home country. Even though we've been in California 10 years and were in the military 10 years before that, I graduated, as Larry mentioned, from the University of Colorado in 1957. I was raised in a little town 150 miles from here up in the mountains, Steamboat Springs. And after getting to places like Hazelden where I could stop my headlong crash downhill, which I thought was a headlong crash towards success in the heights and the pinnacles, including the presidency of the AMA, I realized that even back in that little town, I thought alcoholic, although I didn't know how to drink at the times that I might well have gone out and gotten drunk. At such times, such very important and traumatic times, is when the lady next door beat me in croquet, and I was the best croquet player in Steamboat Springs. Things of this sort. I would have gotten drunk over that if I could have. I know that now, and I've just learned that. But I drank heavily all through school. We used to have what we call Friday afternoon happy hours over at the frat house. I always drank real quick, real fast, so that I could be one of the gang. I never seemed to get caught, though. I got through med school. I got elected to any office I wanted. I seemed to get any appointments I wanted. I got the internship I wanted. I got the residency I wanted. I got everything I wanted and continued to drink, and I never got caught in any of those things because, you see, I wanted those things, but really I didn't deserve them. I was a phony. Phonied my way through med school. Phonied my way through high school as a lay preacher in the Methodist Church. My mother was on the pastoral relations committee. I thought that's why they chose me to give those sermons as a 16 and 18-year-old. It took this program and a little time for reflection to make me realize what a spiritual experience was and to realize that maybe there was some phony and BS in it, but that I wasn't really all that bad. I remember at Hazelden leaning over the sink. I don't know if this will mean anything to you all. I was leaning over the sink on a morning that was totally nondescript. Nothing had happened. I was looking forward to nothing. I'd been there about half my tenure. And I just happened to look up in the mirror and wink at myself. And it felt great. It just a spontaneous wink from Joe Cruz to Joe Cruz. And those are the kinds of things that have been happening over these last 3 to 4 years. And I like it. Just to show you some of the... Of course, when you're phony, you have to drink away that lump in your gut, and I'm not saying anything new. I've heard many, many people say that from the podium. Once you learn to dissolve that lump, why, it makes it much easier. And, of course, the lump dissolves quickly, but the rewards that you're giving yourself or the rewards I gave myself and so on became less and less in terms of the time span, in terms of the amount it took. I'd been in Palm Springs, set up a practice, planned to be the man to take out every uterus and deliver every baby, which means that I'm probably a gynecologist, and that's right. If any of you heard Dr. Paul this morning, you know the story about examining women. Well, I'll tell you, when you're really shaken the next morning, it's tough in my specialty. But I'd been in Palm Springs and really, I don't know why, doing very well. Being so drunk on some nights, having gotten home as quick as I could, get my rear against the kitchen sink and throw them down as fast as I could, eat dinner a little bit, and hit the sack. Being so drunk on some nights, I would answer the clock instead of the phone. My wife say, answer the phone, and I'd say, I am answering the phone. And I'm listening to the clock and wondering why they don't answer on the other end. Some nights, amazingly, get a call from the emergency room or a patient be admitted and the next day not remember this, but look at the orders and they're fine. Functioning in a blackout with none of my colleagues suspecting. 4 years of delivering approximately 250 babies a year, not ever having to go in, I mean never being unable to go in. There were nights that Shirley would fill me with some coffee. I would leave the window down and shake my head all the way to the hospital. But I was never called on the carpet. 4 years. When there was a baby coming, for some reason I wasn't tanked up real badly. That's what I call magic with a capital G. However, on Christmas of 1968, I had had a couple of bourbons at one friend's house while we watched the astronauts go around the moon. We moved out to another place, to a lady's house, where there was a full-fledged party going on. I remember having a double Jack Daniels there, so that makes six, I think, six shots. And to show you that my titer was going down, as I stepped from the kitchen to the living room where this huge Christmas tree was, I realized that I had turned 180 degrees and the ceiling was going away from me. In other words, I was going down fast, and a Christmas tree ornament brushed my ear, and I heard me hit the floor. I didn't feel it, but I heard me. So what do you do in a situation like that? Now, I haven't really heard too many stories from the podium about phoning illness and heart attacks. But if anybody's qualified to do that, having been an Olympic, not Olympic, trying to be an Olympic swimmer, and having excellent cardiorespiratory reserve, being able to hold my breath for almost up to two minutes and 15 seconds, I immediately stopped breathing. Now, there was, and I knew she was, one nurse at the party, and she had never, I don't think she'd ever really practiced. Yes, she'd been an Army nurse, but she hadn't for years. She was married to a television writer. He weighed about 240. He wrote Wagon Train and some of these other stories. He's a real nice guy with a real dapper mustache, but she decided that she would come over and see what had happened and got the ornaments and the tinsel off of me, took my pulse, and made a diagnosis of cardiac arrest. And that was exactly what I was after. She let me have it, and then she comes down and starts giving me the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. I hadn't expected it, but it was fabulous. This girl had an interesting neckline, and if you'll notice, my eyes are narrow. You see, I can see everything going on in this room right now. So each time she came down, the right eye went open just enough. And it was working beautifully. And I could feel her trembling, and I knew that she was quite upset. But I had to carry this out. I had to keep it going. And she tired. And here comes Normie with his big mustache. Good at it. And I will never grow a mustache. I know what my wife would have to go through. But I even carried that out in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. I went ahead and arrested a couple more times. In other words, quit breathing. Able to shallow breathe for up to 5 or 6 minutes. And stayed in the hospital overnight. The cardiologist told my wife to go on home, and I went home the next morning, Christmas morning, with people calling and coming by and quite concerned and upset about my heart attack. I think maybe that kind of qualifies me. I was brought to Denver by my brother-in-law after a suicide attempt. Then I played enough of my cards that finally I had to do it in a grandiose fashion, ended up in my own hospital, taken out of that hospital and brought here to 13th and York by my brother-in-law, who was on the program, and started going to the meetings. But the thing was, I was getting attention. I was getting attention the entire time. And suddenly I quit thinking about why I was there or what was really happening. I enjoyed what was happening, and that's all that really mattered.